Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Perspectives, the show where a conversation about our differences often shows us how much more we have in common. I'm Condice Presley. My guest is Virgil Miller. He is president of Aflac and the first Black man to serve in this role. He is a former United States Marine who served during Desert Storm. He worked for a time in the Aflac call center, and today he oversees North American operations for this $22 billion company. Virgil Miller, welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you so much. Condice, it's my pleasure to be here with you.
Congratulations on the new role. In the last couple of months that you've been in this new position as the president of Aflac, what's been the most surprising thing you've learned?
Well, first of all, I'm just so blessed and honored and thankful to be here. And I take every day and I live every day to its fullest. So really, I'm very excited about getting an opportunity to lead this great organization. Aflac is such a great company, and I'm just very, very pleased. This is my 19th year with Aflac, along with my journey, and my 32nd year in insurance. So I've seen a lot over the years. I can tell you this, what I'm really looking forward to is continue to grow the organization. But really, I enjoy working with people. I am a people person. And so my role gives me the opportunity to work with people here at Aflac, but way beyond Aflac, extend my relationships out into the community. And I am excited to be able to help our teammates here, help the customers that depend upon our products, and really continue to impact the community.
Virgil Miller, what's your story? How does a little boy from the tiny town of Gray, Georgia, near Macon, grew up to be the president of a $22 billion insurance company?
Well, it has certainly been a journey, and it started like a dream. My uncle was very influential in my life. Kind of as a young lad, he gave me my first briefcase. So I carried a briefcase to school when I was a kid, and any kid listening out there, yes, you might get picked on, okay? But stand for what you believe in. And he wanted to make sure. He said that at an early age. He said, Virgil, I think you're going to be a businessman. Now, my definition of a businessman was really him. He wore slacks, a blue coat, and therefore, that's what my vision of this businessman was. So early on in my career, I knew that it was somewhere in my life's journey that I was going to be working in a business environment. And I stuck to that. So I laid a foundation, started with some smaller goals. In high school, I come from a humble family of humble background. Growing up, as you mentioned, in a small town, I knew I'd have to help pay for my education. I actually joined the Marines when I was in 11th grade as a means to help pay for college. So I knew that was going to be part of my journey. And the second part of that, though, I had every intent on going to college, though. And matter of fact, one of the things he taught me well, he said, Virgil, in business, you're going to need to understand the financial aspects. So I knew, and I was very good in math in school. So I knew then I was going to major in accounting. I decided that was going to be my major, probably the 7th or 8th grade. And I went on to major in accounting, got an MBA, and went on to work on a couple of doctorates. So that was my journey. I believe in education. I believe in hard work, but I do believe in setting goals and accomplishing those goals as you go about your journey.
Accounting degree, MBA, worked on a couple of PhDs. How important is the educational pedigree to success?
Yes, I believe education is extremely important. And there are various forms of education, right? Of course, there's the formal education system. I do believe that people, if you get the opportunity and you should try hard to go to college, which is why I'm constantly making sure that one of the things we do here as an organization is, you know, provide scholarships. But I do that I support personally those type of things. But beyond that, I think you should self-educate by just reading material, you know, being aware of what's happening around the world. And also, you know, just reading a variety of articles, you know, make it a point to read an article every single day just to learn something new. Then the last thing I'll say on that kind of stuff is also within your profession, right? Whatever you choose to be in life, make sure you work on your skill set and do whatever you can do to build that. So you mentioned earlier about me starting, you know, entry-level role in insurance. One of the things I made sure of, though, is and the CEO told me this earlier in life. He said, Virgil, do good at what you do. Just try to be the best at that particular role, and there's always opportunity for you. So I've always made sure that I develop the skill set for that particular role. Make sure I understand what the goals are, try to achieve those goals, then opportunities just continue to open up from there.
You're saying the main thing, whatever that is at that time, is the main thing, and that's where your focus should be.
Oh, well said. Absolutely. That has to be the main thing, right? It's like anyone, if you would take a step back and put yourself in the role of a hirer or someone that is looking to bring someone out to help you, and you'll be looking for the same type of things. The first thing you're going to look for is, well, how are they doing in their current role? What is the performance of what we've already given them? A gentleman I used to work with kind of earlier in my career used to say, to as much is given, much is expected. So therefore, why would I give you more than that if you're not doing good with what you already have?
That's a great piece of career advice. Would you say that's the best piece of career advice you've ever received? If not, what else is standing out in your memory?
Well, I'll tell you, another thing that stands out to me is, you know, be the person that you would give your toughest assignment to. This goes back to the Marines. This goes back to earlier in my career. I've always been the one to volunteer for that job, that project, that assignment that maybe someone else doesn't want to take on. And a lot of times I'll tell you, especially in corporate America, that may mean pack it up and move, just like in the military, right? Sometimes what you're looking for may not be right in front of you. You know, I've had to move several times, relocate several times throughout my career, and I've enjoyed every moment of that. So if you're thought of as the one that you can count on to get that job done, then again, you'll be given another opportunity later in life.
Is that what you mean by doing the grunt work and then learning from it?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think there's no job that's not important to the overall mission. As a matter of fact, here at Aflac, I'm reminding people all the time, especially me leading the U.S., every position, every role, every duty, every job counts. There's no job more important than another. Now, my particular role is not about title. It's about the responsibility and what comes with the role that I have. But someone taking a call in the call center, someone opening and sorting out the mail is just as important. If any of those positions don't go right or anything doesn't go right with those roles, we fail the customer. So I'm constantly reminding everyone that whatever you do within this organization is just as important to the overall mission. Translate that back to the military, right? So if you think about the Marines, every role is important to an overall mission. We need people that can fire a weapon. We need people that can also cut a check. Hey, people need to get paid in the military. So it all adds up, kind of.
What do you mean when you talk about walking the perimeter?
So walking the perimeter is a military term for making sure you know what's happening around you, understanding all aspects of what's going to occur when you're trying to actually accomplish a mission. Now, I'm going to translate that back to corporate America. In corporate America, you should always put the customer at the center of all that you do. So if you're here working a role or leading an organization or leading a function in support of the customer, what you should always do is walk the journey of the customer. And how do you do that? Put yourself in his or her footsteps and actually go through the same processes that you're expecting them to go through. So I challenge my leaders on a regular basis to test your processes. And how do you do that? You know, file a claim yourself, call the call center yourself, pay a bill yourself and see if the process works. But also, you know, you've got to have mechanisms to collect feedback from the customer, right? So your journey, ensuring you understand, you know, how all the customers' journeys look like, because there are different ways to do things. Make sure you got a consistent, constant feedback mechanism and that you're doing something with that feedback once you get it.
What is the most challenging feedback you've received in your career and what did you learn from it?
Early in my career, I can tell you as a young manager, one of the things kind of I want to go back to mention about being growing up in a small town. And I always had this, what I call the hero syndrome. Now, my dad was a former military guy also, and he was a master storyteller. And as a young lad, I would hear him tell the stories, but in every story, he would turn out to be the good guy, right? He would be the hero. So I've heard the stories in the military of how he saved people, heard the stories about, he was a military policeman, about how he apprehended the bad guy. Then we all played sports. We're sports fanatics, me and my two older brothers. But he was always the guy to strike out, you know, the last player on the field. I couldn't make these stories add up when I was younger, but he was telling me a story when people were screaming as he walked up with his uniform on. They're like, where's this great player we heard about? The next thing I know, he walks up to the pitcher's mound. Now, he never said how he got from his military uniform to his baseball uniform. So I have to say some of that probably is a little exaggerated. But however, it just intrigued me. I grew up wanting to be the hero. I grew up wanting to serve and help others. It's one of the reasons why I joined the military. It's one of my reasons why I joined the Marines. I said, I want to go into the ones that are going to try to make a difference. So if you fast forward that, that's kind of the foundation of how I was made. You know, I've always thought about how can I be the person to make a difference for someone else? It's the moral fabric of how I'm made. And I was able to, you know, join an organization that thinks like that also. We're always looking at how can we make a difference in the lives of others, not just for the people who have Aflac insurance or our customers, but those beyond. What can we do for those in the community also?
Does the concept of paying your dues still exist?
I absolutely believe you have to pay your dues. And I have two daughters in their 20s. And I have to remind them of that. I was just having a conversation actually with my daughter about this. A lot of times you'll find out now in colleges, you know, and it's good advice. I understand they're being told to make sure that you, you know, negotiate. Sometimes don't accept the first offer. And I was explaining to my daughter, sometimes when you're looking for a particular career where there's an abundance of qualified applicants and out of competition, that may hurt you in the long run, right? And so you need to be keep in mind that sometimes you're going to need to start at an entry level. You're going to need to start and demonstrate your ability to execute that role and to be given that opportunities like I talked about earlier. And if you think about it, when I was coming up, you know, I accepted what I was given. I applied for a role and I can tell you this, the first about seven roles I encountered, I applied for them. But I would tell you this, the last 10 plus jobs, I didn't apply. I was tapped on the shoulder. It's because I demonstrate the ability and I've had them come to me and say, here's what you deserve. I've earned it all the way up. And so I do believe that we have to be careful that in many cases, be open to starting an entry level and working your way up and demonstrating you have the experience. Without the experience, you know, you can't be as helpful as sometimes you may think.
So you're saying success today is still earned and not given.
Yes, that is my belief. And I think that, my particular career has demonstrated that. As I look around, if you would just name off, you know, people that you think success looks different through different forms, right? And success looks different to different people. But if if you and I were just comparing notes now, as we name off a few people we think are successful and just go back and look at their careers, I can tell you this, 9 out of 10 times, it started with them working their way up. It started with hard work and effort. It started with encountering some challenges also, but not letting those obstacles stand in their way, just persevering through every obstacle that's put out in front of them. That's not to say it won't be easy. That's not to say it won't come without challenges, but if you have a plan, you stick to it, you continue to work hard, you develop yourself, you take feedback, you listen, and you learn from what you've encountered, I believe that you can continue to climb. And I would say this, my motto has been though, and as somebody reminded me of this recently, but it is just keep in mind, lift as you climb. I believe if you give back and you help others, then you'll be blessed in return. So I'm always climbing. I'm sweating, putting forth the equity myself, but I'm always reaching back to lift as I am climbing.
How did your college-age daughter respond to that feedback that you gave her about her career prospects, opportunities, and what she was expecting?
She gave me the right rhetoric. however, though, you know, she is trying hard. She gets it. But I would say this, too, that she's had to learn some lessons from it. And what I mean by that, I have been with two companies now for the past 32 years. Loyalty, right? And I stick to it. And again, but I've had opportunities within those organizations. And I would say 25 or more promotions in my career in those 30 plus years, kind of, and opportunities have been there. But my daughter, though, she's not afraid to change organizations. She's moved around quite a lot. But every time she does that, I go back to ask her, what lesson did you learn from the prior role, the prior company? What happened? And I would say that, for her in particular, and maybe the generation, they're not afraid to change. They would change faster than probably someone in my generation at my age. I have to remind them, make sure you learn from that. What did you learn from this role? What did you learn from that particular employer? What went right and what went wrong? So I think now that she's learned from that and she's settling in a lot more, I can tell the difference.
I've got to ask, if over the course of your career, whether it be in the private sector or even in the military, did you experience racism? And if so, how'd you handle it?
Yes, I can tell you racism exists. It does exist. But I can tell you from the bottom of my heart, and you can tell my passion will start to come up a little bit now. I refuse to let it be a barrier. I will not accept it as a barrier to keep me from getting where I want to go on my journey. So I'll tell anyone who's out here listening today, do not let it be an excuse. There's too many of us that have achieved in spite of. So I'll say to answer you, Candace, yes, but I won't let it stop me, right? Yes, but I'm going to do the right thing anyway, because it does exist. And it goes both ways. Racism, a lot of times, has to do with stereotypes and judging someone before you actually know them. And that can work in a lot of different forms. So I've seen it go all the way across the spectrum. But the most important message I would leave you with is, I will not let it be a barrier to what I want to achieve. Marine in me there, Candace.
And that reminds me of something I read about you as a Marine and stereotypes and typecasting people. You had one opinion of your drill instructor and it changed. Can you tell me that story?
Yes, I would love to share that. If you just reflect right now and get an image or a picture of what a Marine drill instructor looks like. There's an image, and there's a reason for that image, because being a Marine requires discipline. It requires rigor. It requires expertise. You don't want someone putting someone's life at stake without the expertise that it calls for. Remember, we are men and women who volunteer to lay down our lives for another. Let's reflect on that. We agree to lay down our lives if it called for it, so that someone else could have freedom. Now, having said that, in the military, it requires a special person. So these drill instructors are tough. And so there's an image. And when I first got into boot camp, I was terrified. And these guys were just like you're probably thinking. And one night I was walking, we call it fire watch, but the long and short of it is you have to have someone who's guarding to make sure there's no intruders and someone is not trying to escape. And it still happens today on Parris Island for all those people, those Parris Island Marines listening. And there was my bunkie one night in the bathroom, as we would say in the military, in the head, attempted to kill himself. And he was trying to slit his wrist. And so I had to go wake up the drill instructor. Now, that is something you don't want to do. In the middle of the night, you don't want to wake these guys up. But I did anyway. And so after getting a, as we would call it in the country, kind of a good old chewing out, okay? After being thrashed and harassed a little bit, he then asked me what I wanted. I said, recruit McKay. He is attempting to kill himself. So he says, you stay here. So I watched him. Now, of course, I didn't stand there. I watched him go into the restroom. And he picked this young man up off the floor. Now, it was not to the extent that he was about to die. He had definitely slit his wrist, and you would see bleeding, but he was able, we were, of course, able to sustain him, and he's lit up from there. My point, though, is I decided to peep around the corner, and seeing this intimidating force hold this young man in his arms and say, son, in a very quiet, meek voice, son, it's going to be okay. this is not for everybody, you know, and that's okay. We're going to get you out of here and we're going to get you in something that's better suited for you. And I was like, wow, he's a real person, right? And so he's actually become what we need him to become in the aspect of being a Marine, but he has a genuine heart. He's not that guy that I could see that doesn't care and it is this intimidating gentleman that is always in my face. And then I saw then, kind of, so I said, there are a couple of things, right? You know, hey, listen, make sure you understand the why. Understand the why. And that's what I did. I said, okay, well, they need me to be a Marine. I'm going to become a Marine. So I ended up graduating after being promoted couple times in boot camp and graduating what we consider to be in the number one position coming out.
To what do you attribute, Virgil? And that's a remarkable story. Thank you for sharing that. Clearly, it had an impact on you then and the leader that you've grown into today. To what do you attribute your overall success?
There's not one thing. I will point out a couple of things. It starts, though, with caring. I believe that I just care about people. And when I go into anything, my first thing to do is to build relationships. We're in this world together. I don't believe there's no one man on the island. And again, the great opportunity I have today is to lead the U.S. in a role for a company whose overall culture is summed up in the slogan of care on purpose. So it matches. I believe, you know, if you care about something, people will understand it and they'll get a hold of your passion. I'm a very passionate person. When you demonstrate trust and care for your employees as a leader, I was telling that earlier, I learned that coming up the ranks, demonstrate trust and passion as a leader. And you ever heard the old adage, right? Teaching someone to fish, right? Same thing here. If you're pouring to someone and you're teaching them how to fish, they know that you've got their overall well-being at heart, they're going to give you more commitment and loyalty. So at the center of all of it, I would have to go with caring. And that's what I've done throughout my career.
You're a couple of months into your new role, and I know that you have metrics by which you'll be evaluated by the stakeholders and the stockholders at Aflac. But what personal goals have you set for yourself? In what way will your values be manifest in the organization that you now lead?
One of the things that resonate with me today, of course, is Black History Month. And you have a Black man from a small town here. By the way, I want to just shout out that I replaced a Black female, Teresa White, my mentor and confidant, great friend of mine, did a great job in leading as president for many years. One tip that I'll throw out also, kind of in the spirit of Black History Month, you have an Omega replacing a Delta. I just throw that tidbit out for all the listeners. I would say, though, that diversity is extremely important to me and extremely important to the organization. But it is inclusion, but not exclusion. We want to make sure everyone is treated fair and consistent throughout the organization. But I do want to make sure, though, that we continue to represent the communities where we do business and work in. We make a difference in the communities where we work, live in, and have a customer base at. And then I want to make sure, though, that we put forth the effort to make the world better than what we found it. Now, we do this in two ways, as I mentioned earlier. We do this by way of making sure we have innovative products that can make a difference. When you see our commercials and advertisements, we're trying to educate on the fact that if you have a medical event, you may not have savings or the ability to take care of some of the other things that go around that. Things like your deductible, things like hotel for a loved one if they need to come take care of you, things like being out of work. And that's what our insurance does. So when you hear us talking about, you know, fulfilling the gap, making sure that underserved people understand that, people that don't have any money in savings. But the other thing, though, is we put our money where our mouths are. We're out making donations. We've made donations, and I could go down a whole list of things I won't do in the essence of time, but we make donations in the community. Whether it's sickle cell anemia, whether it's HBCUs, whether it's just other things in the community that are trying to help people who need us most. My commitment is to continue to do that and to make sure, though, that Aflac is healthy financially and we're healthy by way of having the right talented people in positions that can help us carry out that mission.
We are talking with Aflac President Virgil Miller. In a moment, he'll tell us how everyone can make greater impact. And I'll introduce you to an unsung shero of the voting rights movement. This is Perspectives. Welcome back. You're listening to Perspectives, and I'm Condice Presley. Aflac President Virgil Miller is my guest. And Virgil, in what ways would you like to see more successful Black people giving to the community?
I grew up in the church, and if one of my good friends was a pastor there in Atlanta, well, he's probably going to know exactly what I'm talking about. But one of my earlier pastors had a couple of sayings with that, right? He used to say, I give because I have, and I have because I give. So I believe the gift of giving. Now, giving, though, goes beyond just money. Now, trust me, though, you financial giving is extremely important because it takes money to make certain things happen. But there's also the gift of time. There's a gift of sharing, right? So how do you share? Mentorship, being an advocate to someone to help them grow, sharing your experiences, sitting on nonprofit organization boards to give back. And I sit on boards like that to make sure, but I think there's a whole lot of things. Another thing he used to say, Condice, is if I could just touch the life of one, my life should not have been lived in vain. So if I could just help one person, that person pays it along. That lifting as you climb mentality, if everyone would take that, I believe we can help a lot of people. So, and again, maybe you don't have the financial means, but you can give your time, your effort, your resources. And then sometimes you can just, you know, people are in need of other small things, things that you may have, clothes, other essential items just to help. And so I'll sum it up to tell you that one thing we can all do is serve. And that means serving one another.
And you have certainly served, and you've served our country. Thank you for your service and serving in this new role that you have as president of Aflac North America. Virgil Miller, appreciate your time. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity to share.
As Black History Month segues into Women's History Month, we have a history maker as our guest. She's Helen Butler, a voting rights advocate in our community and among one of the first 100 Black Americans to study at the University of Georgia. Helen Butler, welcome.
Well, thank you, Candace, for having me here. I'm so honored to be a part of this program.
Well, we are honored to have you as a guest. Tell us about being among the first 100 Black students enrolled at UGA after Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes. You enrolled in 1967, I believe.
Yes. Well, coming from a small town like Madison and Buckhead, Georgia, it was quite a shock to see so many people on campus because I came from a small school. But again, more shocking than that was not being in a classroom with anyone that looked like me, not having a professor that looked like me, not being able to, really converse with classmates about what does this mean, how can we study together, that kind of thing. The only time I saw other Black people were in the student center, and that's where we met for lunch or our snacks or a playing card sometimes. But it was there that I guess I really understood that I could compete, because that was one of the things in the 60s. People were always saying Black people can do this, they can do that. But I proved to myself, and as they did also, that we could do anything we set our mind to, regardless of what barriers are put in front of us. We did it, and that's what we did.
What made you choose the University of Georgia over perhaps enrolling in an HBCU like Spelman?
Well, quite honestly, I got a scholarship to Spelman, and I turned it down because, again, living in Morgan County back in the 60s, if I went to a restaurant. I had to pick up my food and take it out. I could not sit down. There was a colored white only section. And people made you think like you're inferior. Well, when integration came, it told me that, hey, Black people could compete with anyone, not just white people could compete with anyone. And so I had that determination to say that I will be able to compete. And that's what I did.
Did you live on campus?
Yes, I lived on campus. Was in Brumby Hall. It was the dormitory that I lived in. Predominantly white. A couple of Black students were on, living in the dorm. I had a white roommate initially, so that was different. Even had the white girls on in the dorm asked me to iron their clothes, and I go like, I don't iron my own, you better take them to the laundry. It's that kind of stereotype that people really didn't understand. Of course, they weren't overtly rude, but very condescending sometimes, as if I didn't belong there.
Did you ever consider transferring to another school, perhaps an HBCU?
No, I didn't. And the reason I didn't is because I had gotten a scholarship to Spelman before I went to UGA, and I turned it down. So I was determined to make sure that I graduated from the University of Georgia. And why did I want to do that? Because I felt like, you know, people talked about in the 60s, we were inferior, we couldn't do this. We couldn't go at a counter and get food. We had to take it out the back door. You couldn't go sit down, that kind of thing. So I wanted to see why they were different and could I compete? And to myself, I had to prove that I could compete.
You studied accounting and were going to be a Black woman with a degree in corporate America in the early 70s, and yet your career path led you into the social justice field. Tell me that story. How did that change happen?
Well, I did get a degree in accounting, and I went to work for General Motors in Doraville. In fact, Alexis Herman, who was the labor secretary at one point, owned a recruitment firm for Black females. And that's how I got an interview with General Motors. And once I was hired there, I was put on a fast track to become one of the first Black female controllers for the corporation. I went to Warren, Michigan for a year, had to shovel myself to work every day, didn't like it, came back to Atlanta and went to work for a grocery chain. And changed fields totally. Became a VP of HR for a regional chain called Colonial Stores, Grand Union. And after they closed down, my brother was the state conference president of the NAACP. And he said, well, you don't want to retire. Come on over here. Let's work on some civic engagement stuff. And I go like, I haven't done that, but okay, I'll give it a try. So that's how I became engaged in voting rights and civil rights activities. Even though at UGA, we formed our own Black Student Union, I was a member of that. We formed our own sororities because we couldn't pledge the white sorority. So, you know, I was used to doing things out of the box, so why not do this out of the box? So I came to work with the NAACP Voter Fund, worked with them for 2 years, met Dr. Lowry because the NAACP and Dr. Lowry and Earl Schoenoster and Reverend Orange, Rita Samuels, all came together in this organization called the People's Agenda. It was supposed to be different because it was made up of organizational heads, meaning that if all the organizations could come together, instead of making a dent with the thumb, if you all come together, you make much more power by a fist together, working together. So I joined them after the NAACP's program ended. Dr. Lowry and Reverend Orange said, well, come on over here and work with us. And that's it. I've been there ever since.
So tell us about the work of the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda, where you now serve as executive director.
And basically what it is improving the quality of governance by getting elected officials who will implement policies that will change our communities. That's the thrust of it. It's really to make sure that we have educated, mobilized, and accountable elected officials to the people that will put in place policies that will improve our communities. And that's the thrust of it, is that organizations with like our goals and agenda come together to make sure that we get things done for our community. And our community primarily is African American, but we also do people of color.
What do you say to the people who argue that the time for organizations such as yours is in our rearview mirror, not in our future?
What I would say to them, you've got to have something to build on. And if you look at the strategies that the civil rights movement used during those days, we're still using some of them. They may be called something different, but they're same kinds of tactics. And so you got to have the wisdom to know how to go forward and build something new. You got to see what has happened, how it happened, what made it happen, how can you make it better. So our time is not over. Our time is to continue that the young people take the mantle and continue the legacy. The civil rights movement was won by young people. The older people had to work. The young people could stand out in the street and organize. But the older people were behind the scenes negotiating. So it takes all of the tactics to make it work. And not one is going to be better than the other. It's just different iterations of what you might call. Back in the day, they had mimeographs. Today, you got social media. The ways of touching people, getting in the community with people, is always going to be that way. And it takes us one-on-one helping each other to learn the process, to be engaged in that process. It's not a one-person thing. It's a team effort. Everything we've done at the People's Agenda has been intergenerational. It has been with all of us working together.
Are you finding that this next generation of young people are engaged and excited, and that there are folks who are open and willing to continuing this work?
Oh, yes, I am really enthusiastic about that. I see so many young people like Mary Pat Hector, who started at age 10 working in this field, trying to make change. I see her young brother Mason, who's doing it from an entrepreneurial process, building his own business, but bringing along people, training them how to do that. It's all of us taking the village. I mean, there are so many young people that you see, Insay Ufot, Anna Dennis. I mean, there are Lyndon Waller, who's my deputy director, young people that are engaged and understand what public policy means, and that you got to have the right people making those policies to make our lives better.
Of all the names you just mentioned, the majority of them are women. In your opinion, why do you think that especially Black women are the ones who stand so strongly in this social justice space?
Well, as you know, Black women have always had to stand strong for the family. When you see the Black woman, she takes care of herself, her family, her community. So it's natural that Black women sometimes takes that lead, because sometimes it's more acceptable for us to take the lead than the Black guys, but Black guys are engaged as well. I can see Reverend Jared Sawyer, a young minister who is out there on the field doing the same thing. I can see my nephew who's getting involved in, you know, what does political mean? What does it mean to be politically engaged? How can I make a difference just as one individual? Not for everybody, but what can I do individually that will impact everyone else? And I am so enthusiastic about the young people. If you look at the young group now talking about education, critical race theory, they're debunking all of that myth because they understand that, you know, it's about history and you gotta know your history to be engaged to make sure the future is better.
I saw you in the docuseries, The 1619 Project. How did that come to be?
Oh, that was a lifetime honor to be in that documentary with Nicole Hannah-Jones to really talk about connecting how Black people have made contributions, how Black people still are making contributions, and why it's critical that we know that and understand that. So it was just a thrill for me to be a part of that, to have my team highlighted as a part of that. And it showed some of the work we were doing. One of the clips was about this high-rise, senior high-rise, who was put into a precinct 20 miles away. They had no transportation per se. They never voted there, would have had to vote a provisional ballot, didn't want to vote a provisional ballot. But we were able to work with the election officials to say, look, it was your fault that they're in the wrong place. They need to vote a regular ballot, and they were allowed to do so. It's that kind of fulfillment. It's the little things we do. We provided over 700 rides to the polls. Free rides to the polls, you know, just getting people there. We didn't care who they voted for, what they voted for. If you needed a ride, we'll give you that ride. And it's just so fulfilling because people go like, oh, I couldn't have gotten to vote if you didn't. Helping the blind people who want to vote independently, but be able to take them to the polls, to let them vote on the equipment. It just gives you great reward to see people exercising their right. And once they know how to do it, when to do it, they'll do it. And you don't have to tell them who to vote for because they're very educated.
Ms. Butler, you could be retired, traveling, enjoying the good life, doing whatever you want to do, and yet you're still working. Why?
I guess I got hooked. Dr. Lowry said it takes a lot of crazy people to do civil rights work. Well, I guess I'm one of those crazies because I believe that I don't have children of my own, but I have nieces and nephews. I have community children that I work with that I want to see them do much better than I ever did. And someone helped me, like my fourth grade teachers, taught me what I needed to do. You know, people gave me the opportunity, like Alexis Herman, to interview with these corporations that allowed me to go where I got. So I want to give back to the young people and to see them thrive and do much better than we'll ever do. And that's what drives me.
Helen Butler, we stand on your shoulders. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Perspectives is a community and public affairs program produced with you in mind. If there's a guest or an issue you'd like to hear me explore, I hope you'd let me know. The easiest way to connect with me is on social media. Just slip me a DM or send me a message. Search Condice Presley on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And yeah, I know you're asking, how do you spell Condace? C-O-N-D-A-C-E. And Presley has two S's. That's P-R-E-S-L-E-Y. SSLEY. Friends, I appreciate your listening. Be sure to listen again next week at the same time as we explore new perspectives.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.